but an organization per se. And so in their wisdom, and I think very rightly so, of course, they brought back the squadron system. So they formed or reformed the 1st Canadian Escort Squadron in 1954. And Algonquin was named the leader, and then there were three frigates that formed, made up the squadron, Toronto, Prestonian, and Lausanne. And so they needed one of each brand as a squadron staff officer, squadron navigator, squadron task, squadron communicator, and they needed a squadron direction officer. So I got pulled out of Shearwater after just a year and what we call pierheaded into Algonquin on a week's notice. But we were also ship's officers as well, so we were double-hatted. So you were an Algonquin officer and squadron staff. And the captain of Algonquin was captain of the ship and also the squadron commander. So we were in that ship, we all rushed around to two hats on. And that was great. That was great 2 years. That was super 2 years because we did a lot of steaming. We got the squadron principal back on the line, got it going again. Formed the staff, and away we went.
This would be the good old days for you, back at sea.
Yeah, that's right. And that was good fun. And we did a couple of really good glamour
trips. You don't have two hats now, though, do you? You have your squadron commander,
you have your,
and then you have a captain
that's
of the
right.
ship.
And that changed in the middle 60s. And we moved away from the squadron commander driving his own ship. The principal, and rightly so again, being that if he was driving his own ship, he could never go and ride in the others and just see how they were doing and go there to inspect them or to encourage them or to help them or what have you, whatever was needed, because he was you know, anchored. Now, in fact, Captain Hennessy was my squadron commander, and he, in fact, from time to time, would turn the ship over to the first lieutenant, and this became the normal thing. And the squadron commander ship always had a very senior lieutenant commander as the executive officer, which allowed the captain to go and pay short visits to one of the other ships.
So wouldn't he have enough things on his mind as driving the one ship? He's got four ships.
Oh, he had a lot on his mind. But nowadays, the squadron commander will probably go and ride in a particular ship for a month or 2 months at a time. So he gets to know the ship, he gets to know all the people in the ship, which makes for a much better, you know, relationship from everybody's point of view. And then he's given a small staff of officers and senior chief petty officers to.
Does he then move his flag to another ship?
Yeah, he takes his flag.
Permanent
flag. No, he takes his flag with him and takes his staff, his chief yeoman and his electronic warfare petty officer and his operations officer and so on. And then they all go as a little package from ship to ship.
Do the captains here wish to see them come on there before?
Oh, most captains have mixed feelings. I used to sort of say, well, it's nice to have you with us, boss, but I'll be glad when you go.
You're running things my way.
Yeah, right.
You did this for 2 years. I guess you wouldn't have too much time to think. Or
well, it was the time of the beginning of the beginning of the big NATO exercises. We did what was it called? Morning mist or morning departure, which was the about the first of the big transatlantic exercises. We did a first of a series of U.S. Canadian exercises up the East Coast, a series called New Broome that went from, we did New Broome 1, and I think they went up through about New Broome 8 or 9 before they finally changed the pattern a bit. So it was all very much of a the early phase, the learning phase for everybody, and it was a very, very interesting phase.
What about Korea?
And well, Korea had sort of had come and was on, you know, underway, and I was unfortunately not lucky enough to be in the ship that was sent to Korea. Some of the Halifax ships were sent off to Korea. The tribals were sent to Korea, but it started halfway through my RMC time. And then I had 6 months in the frigate, ready to get my feet wet again and just sort of brush up on navigation for the long course. And then my long course, and so by the time I'd done that, the whole thing had just about worn down. So I missed it, damn it. Because that, of course, is that sort of thing is where you get the ultimate in experience. And this is where, I think so many of our super destroyer drivers of that era, of course, all rose to be the admirals and the commodores of the late 50s and into the 60s. The
mm-hmm.
people who'd gone out and done their thing there. But I missed it, damn it.
You missed the other one, too. You just finished your course and it was VE Day on board. I don't know if you missed it. I think you lived a charmed life.
Well, I didn't miss the old Archie Bunker says I didn't miss all of the big one, or
no.
WW2.
WW2, the big one.
So Algonquin was a good time for me. It was being double-headed. You know, you had your own ship's life, but we also did a lot of riding in the other ships, and it was sort of an early training to be a staff officer.
You were promoted to lieutenant commander.
When I came out of there, yeah, and then I went off to Ottawa for my first penance.
Director of Naval Direction.
Yeah,
navigation
direction, yeah.
What the hell is that?
That was, well, if you remember when I mentioned we had the old specialists, the C
mm-hmm.
and the D and the TAS and what have you. Well, in NDHQ, Naval Service, or NSHQ, there was a directorate for each of the principal warfare systems. And so being a direction officer, or the ND branch, I went in as one of two staff officers in the Directorate of Navigation and Direction. So I did the, what we call AIO and radar, in other words, action information and radar, which is the ops side. And then my sidekick did the navigation side. And then there was a commander as the director. And so that was first experience of really sitting behind a desk and writing staff papers and doing all this paperwork stuff that we get buried with.
Mm-hmm.
But it was long after that they sent me off to staff college to learn how to do it.
The Army and stuff. I was wondering, now you come into Ottawa, you have Claxton and his crew in there.
Yeah, I'm glad you told me that. I couldn't have, if you said who was the minister at the time, there was no way I could have told you.
I got my cheat sheet. You have Plax and the Liberals, Sam Morrell. Finance-wise, distribution of the defense dollar, the Air Force was getting the cream. There's no question about that. The in the 50s, the Navy was getting like 14.4 to 14.7%
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Air Force was getting the big 41%.
Mm-hmm.
How was the feeling? And I mean, you're in Ottawa, you're in the seat of power now,
yeah.
You hear a lot of the grumbling out.
But, you know, on the other hand, don't forget, we were pretty enthused at that time because, you know, we had our Saint-Laurent program going full blast, and we were churning out destroyers, and they were all brand new. And then one of my jobs, in fact, was to go down to the shipbuilders in Sorel and Lausanne and Montreal and do trials on the new ships, on the the radars and the operations room equipment and so on. So I don't think as a very junior staff officer we were sort of muttering in the mess and saying the wretched Air Force have got a bundle and we're sitting here still, you know, running around in Noah's Ark. We had new ships coming along. We knew that they were as good as, if not better, than any other ship that was in production. They were ships ahead of the Leanders, for instance, that the Royal Navy brought out. The Algonquin was an interesting ship in that she was the Canadian equivalent to the Rocket and the Relentless, which were the first RN ships to have the big bridge superstructure put on with the big operations room instead of the captain standing on the bridge and looking seaward and saying fire when you see the whites of their eyes and all that good stuff. He was down in the ops room fighting the ship from the ops room. And Algonquin was the first conversion that we made. With Crescent as the second one. And from the lessons learned there, in those conversions, of course, came the Saint-Laurents and the Restigouches. So we were, you know, pretty enthused. Now, I can remember being frustrated. For example, my chum across the desk who did the navigation side wanted desperately to put in a centralized clock system with a master clock and all sorts of repeaters, so everybody knew what time it was, and it was the same time. And a good example of how things can get fouled up is was when I was in Algonquin, we had a yet another collision at sea. I seem to suffer a few of those. And because, you know, naturally there's a board of inquiry. And the first thing, the question is, when did it happen? And it was very, very difficult. I remember the navigator at the time spent about half a day trying to figure out exactly what time did the collision happen. Because, you know, the officer watch, if he thought to look at the time when the bang happened, glanced at the bridge clock, and we'll say it was 9 o'clock. When he looked at the engine room register, it was 9:03, because the guy writing up the register was running on his wristwatch. If you looked in the operations room log, it was a different time altogether, because the RP was using his watch. And only sort of once a day did sort of, you know, the navigator's yeoman put out a general time check, when theoretically, everybody was supposed to set all the clocks to the same time, but of course they'd get missed. So, you know, it was pretty simple to put in a central clock system. It was going to cost, I think it was something like $3,000 per ship. And there was no way that we could get that through the naval board and screening process to get those $3,000 per ship. So money was tight. Very, very tight.
You get the ship, but you couldn't get the...
The, you know, little things like that.
Yeah.
You know, so I guess we were aware that money was tight, you know, but we didn't. I remember we didn't sort of sweat blood over it. But I don't, you know, let's face it, you know, you're talking of what year are we talking about now? 55.
55.
So a 30-year-old brand new lieutenant commander sort of being told to write a paper on something or other, you know. But as an interesting aside too, I mean, if you talk about how things advance, myself and my sidekick, we wrote a combined paper on replacing the Sperry navigation radar in those ships with a Decca for installation in about 1960-62 time frame. It didn't get off the ground. And the Sperry radar is still in those ships in the harbor today.
Well, this is leading me to the next question, is if you're enthused about the restitution of San Juan Class, how do you feel today that the restitution
How are they?
Yeah, it's...
They're good. Sure, there's a lot of kit we'd like to have put into them. You know, I mean, if we had an inexhaustible budget, I'd say, sure, let's get all 280s. Let's get automated command and control, you know, computer assists and all the other magic things that we have today. People tend to say that in the real war and the real battle that they'd never be able to keep up, because the information flow would be strangled because it's all manual, or so much of it is manual, etc., etc. That the weapons themselves are not capable of coping. Well, I'm not really fully in agreement with that. I mean, sure, they're not the top of the heap, but they're certainly not the bottom of the heap by any means.
Well, how did you feel
the DDH, you know, the San Juan conversion to with the helicopter is a good system.
Yeah.
The ASRock system in the IREs out here is a very good system. So yeah, they'd be effective. When I was captain of Yukon, we were able to play with nuclear submarines and hang on to them. Now maybe, you know, we're talking what, 8 or 9 years ago. I would say even today, now with the variable depth sonar and so on, that the nuclear submarine is not necessarily going to be able to get away scot-free and do his own thing as he wants. Saying, well, it's only a Canadian ship up there, I don't have to worry about him. But the problem is, of course, is that the physical age of the plant now is beginning to catch up. And it's like old aeroplanes, it means more man hours have to go into maintenance to keep the things running. Spare parts are getting more difficult to get hold of. You know, the guy who built the main feed pump, if he hadn't gone out of business, he certainly hasn't built a pump like that for 20 years. So when you say the widget is broken, can I have another one? He says, well, I don't make those anymore. I haven't got any left in the shelf.
Mm-hmm. why you have a machine shop here?
That's why dockyards have to now do more and more actual sort of building as opposed to repair. So, you know, the old curve of sort of maintenance costs
mm-hmm.
start to go up, and eventually it sort of reaches the point where it's completely uneconomical to keep it going.
I was wondering, during 55, 56, 57, that we have a lot of Canada's defense program, and it's all, from a superficial glance probably, but it all seems to be air-oriented,
mm-hmm.
mine and missiles
mm-hmm.
and all this type of thing. And again, the defense dollar distribution of the defense dollar, the Army's getting 26%, the Navy 16, and the Air Force 42, 44.
You know, of course, that was in the days of the Mid-Canada line and the Pine Tree line and all the other lines that were going in. And the manned bomber was still there, and the...
Yeah.
Air defense of North America was still a big thing.
Nice
and,
too.
You know, now the Arrow sort of spun in about that time, but,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The, and the other thing, of course, I suppose that Canada as a nation in recent years, certainly, I think, has been far more air-oriented. I mean, if you think back to the war, the Empire Air Training Scheme, the glamour of the air, the Air Force per se, was the popular thing, the thing with the greatest impact on the population at large. The side of service sort of did its thing at both ends, but really people didn't know much about it. And I think this was a carryover, coupled with the fact that the Air Force have always had been very, very good at their staff work and writing up the justification for this, for that, and for the other. And
you didn't feel you were going to be out of a job.
Oh, never know we're going to be out of a job. Oh, no, no.
You don't feel that way
now? No, no, not the least bit. If I was 20 years younger, there's no way I'd feel that I was going to be out of a job, that the Navy would cease to exist, that there would be there's no more requirement for maritime forces. And in fact, if anything, I would say that the pendulum is beginning to swing the other way, that I think that the requirement for maritime forces is much easier to understand in the mind of the general public than the need for instance, the new fighter aircraft. I mean, if I was John Q. Citizen, who took perhaps a cursory glance at the press about defense, and somebody said that government was going to spend $1 billion plus or $2 billion, whatever it is, on a new fighter airplane, part of which was required for air defense of North America, I'd say, what for? Now the ground attack role and army support, that's a different ball game. I mean, that's understandable.
Mm-hmm.
The other is much more difficult to understand. I don't even profess to really understand it myself. Maybe I'm being heretical, but it does make me wonder. And the only thing I can reconcile it down to by saying, well, if there was absolutely nothing there at all, then the opposition, whoever they may be, could bumble across in an airship or a balloon and get away with it because there'd be nobody to stop him.
Well, how do you feel then about the maybe it's a changing role of the Canadian Air, the Maritime Forces? It's these big airplanes with all the radar and the gizmos
mm-hmm.
inside, and it's not on the water; it's in the air, and it's air oriented.
No, I think the Maritime Forces now is credible in the eyes of the public because of the 200-mile economic zone for starters. Somebody's got to go out there and say this is ours. And you know, there comes a point, eventually, probably, when you know, you're going to have to at least look a little bit fierce to tell some guy go away.
Presence.
Yeah. And so the physical presence of a warship, it's no sense sending out a submarine because nobody knows he's there, and the aircraft is only good in the sense that he can record a side number or a name
mm-hmm.
and report it back. But in the meantime, the guy who's out there sort of can really thumb his nose and say, well, hello, wave as he goes by. But if you've got to get him out of there, there's only one vehicle that'll get him out of there, and that's a ship. Now, whether it's a fishery protection or whether it's a naval vessel, they both have the potential to do it, but so you combine the two together. then you have a warship which is capable of meeting all roles from straight, you know, sovereignty patrolling right through to the big crunch if it ever comes. And this is why I think the talk at one stage of sort of the ship replacement program being in fact just a small patrol boat was sort of bandied around in high places in the sort of political arena. You know, why does the Navy need these exotic, expensive warships with all these big guns and all the rest of it? Why don't they just have a small patrol boat? Well, that's fine if all you're going to do is tell Joe Snooks to take his fishing boat and go somewhere else. But until we know for sure that nobody's going to get nasty, then you've got to be prepared to look after your country as well.
You end up in Washington, D.C., and the Canadian Joint Staff. That must have been quite an experience.
Yeah, that was another high spot in my checkered career.
In that big gray building up on
Massachusetts Avenue.
Massachusetts, yep. Yeah.
The Joint Staff in those days had a small cell with a chairman who was a two-star officer, and he paralleled the Joint Staff in Ottawa. If you remember, he used to be led for years by General Foulkes, and then there was a one-star from each service, and he had a staff. And again, we go back to the old war cry, there was one of each breed. There was a gunner and a task officer and a communicator and an ND officer, that was myself, and an engineer and an electrical officer and a spy officer and so on. And it was our job to be the interface between USN and RCN. And it was a two-way street, really. We would respond to requests from the USN for what the RCN was doing in a certain field, perhaps. Not so much as that, as much the other way, where headquarters would ask us to find out what the Americans were doing or what developments there were in certain fields of mutual interest. And so it was a liaison job. I was lucky because we were just at that time really getting into the automatic data processing business. The RCN, in spite of its small percentage of the total defense budget, had in fact gone ahead and developed the first digital transmission system of information flow. And it was developed by a team of our own engineers in Naval Headquarters in conjunction with Ferranti, which was a Canadian subsidiary of the Ferranti in England. And they had put together a computer and display systems, and they had one ashore at Scarborough, Ontario, and they had two Bangor minesweepers that they fitted this kit into, and they had them out on Lake Ontario. And they had a UHF data link, and they would exchange information and so on. And the Americans were, at that time, developing NTDS, Naval Tactical Data System. And believe it or not, they were very interested in quite a lot of the work that we had done in this. And so really I became, from the operational side, the primary link between RCN and USN. And then our electrical officer and the staff, of course, was the primary link on the technical side. And one of the things, of course, that everybody realized right from the beginning was that the Allies were going to work together. And it was therefore no sense for the Canadians to go off and develop a system of language, with the Americans going in a divergent path and the Brits somewhere else. And so we formed a Canada.
We're of NATO also, aren't we? We're making
a NATO, that's right. It was all part of NATO.
But NATO work, isn't that the idea?
But the big three, CAN, UK, US, within the NATO orbit, quite often did and probably still do certain things that don't necessarily go right across the field
well,
in NATO.
Well, the triangle, of course, the historic, every economic...
right, the whole ball of wax there. Right. So the development of this common language really became probably the major part of my business, where we literally wrote a language for computers to talk to each other, which was known by that nice short title of Tide, no relation to the soap, which was short form for Tactical International Data Exchange, which seemed to come out rather nicely. And Canada, having done so much work in the ASW field, we in fact became the prime, or the Office of Primary Interest, the OPI, for the ASW facet of this this thing. And so we would meet sort of weekly in Washington with the USN, my counterpart from the British staff and myself. We would meet quarterly with a team from headquarters, and the team would come over from UK. And then twice during my time there, in fact, the two annual meetings, we sort of moved around. So we had one over in London, and we had one up in Ottawa. And that was a real fascinating time. It was just the really real beginnings of all this now sophisticated gear that when you go down to a 280 or you go down to the USN, you see it all. This was really the Model T Ford, and yet digitally speaking, as opposed to analog computers, this really was the Canadians got in on the first digital transmission system. And it was really masterminded by a delightful civilian engineer by the name of Stan Knight, who was the mastermind. And he also developed the thing now, which is you see everywhere, called a ball tracker. And then before this thing came along, everybody was fascinated with what they call the joystick control. And you had this little joystick that was movable in all degrees of motion. So when you wanted to move a spot across the face of a cathode ray tube, you could make it go east, west, north, south, or anything in between. But it was tricky to move. You know, you had to move your wrist, and it wasn't smooth. And old Stan Knight suddenly thought of the idea of a rolling ball that would do the same thing. And he built his first breadboard model by going down to the local bowling alley in Ottawa and borrowing a bowling ball and setting it up on, you know, little roller bearings. And out of that came the ball tracker. And I don't think he ever patented it. Otherwise, he'd be a millionaire today, because everybody has ball trackers. And that was about 1951, I guess, because I saw the trial system up the Great Lakes when I was in Ottawa in 54, I guess it was. So I guess it would be about 51 when he started it.
Anybody
else? Now everybody has, yeah. But that was a very interesting time. Then, of course, I mean, you know, the requests were legion. For instance, the Americans were then using a plotting table in the operations room to record ship's movement, and then you'd plot your radar contacts on it, and you had a true picture developed on paper with the pencil and so on. And the British had a plotting table which was much superior to the American DRT, as it was called. And the British ARL table, which stands for the Admiralty Research Laboratories, and they developed this table. We had used them for years. We had them in Algonquin and so on. And then we, in turn, refined that. And that development was going on when I was in Ottawa, and that was one of my jobs as a staff officer in Ottawa, to get this thing out and in production and so on. And anyhow, the Americans got very interested. And so we loaned them two tables for trials, and they put one in the carrier and one in the destroyer. Well, then, being in Washington, then it was my job to go down and see them, see how they were doing, if they needed spare parts or advice for maintenance. I'd get hold of the company in Toronto and send a tech rep down to fix it and so on. And so that was the sort of thing. It was a two-way liaison sort of thing. And Tom Wish, you met a tremendous number of delightful Americans, and I think they're super people. I really do. They're so good to us. And So we had two and a half glorious years in Washington.
You didn't feel like the poor cousin, eh?
No. Sometimes the embarrassed cousin, embarrassed by the generosity of the Americans, sometimes embarrassed by the one-wayness of the street. You know, they would send so much our way, and so little in a sense we could give back, and yet sometimes we'd sit and pound the table and say, well, we want to do it this way and that way. And I used to say to myself, gee, you know, what right do we have to tell them what to do? You know.
Well, did you notice any significant change with the change of government? We have Diefenbaker and the Conservatives coming in at this period, or you guys just had a job to do and political masters were left to themselves?
The only thing I remember there was being in Washington, of course, voting out of country. You know, being a serviceman, you could vote anyhow. Mm-hmm. But the Washington press, I don't recall really giving too much coverage to the big election up north of the border.
Fair enough. But you know, you're only there for 2.5 hours
and
you're back.
2.5 years.
Yeah.
Glad it wasn't 2.5 hours.
Before the slip, and you get command.
And then off to sea, yep.
Lanark, you get command.
Yeah. And that's, of course, what everybody, really, at least all fish heads, join for, you know. You don't care whether it's a battleship or a rowboat, you know, you want to...
You want to
drive your own vessel, yeah. And so I don't quite know whether I walked on the ceiling or what, but I know when that message came out, I was a pretty, pretty happy guy. I'd served in a frigate once and for 6 months out here in Antigonish, just for a short spell. So I didn't really know the ships that well. And of course they had been converted to the Prestonian class in between time. But that didn't bother me. It was a ship, and somebody said, you know, and all those hours of studying for destroyer command exams and what have you had obviously paid off. And The only thing, I guess, looking back, I guess I'm one of the few people who was never an executive officer. I was never an XO of a ship. And not now, but I remember at the time when I was sort of getting into this business of being captain of the ship, and my XO would come along and we'd talk about this, and I sometimes used to feel to myself, you know, I wish perhaps I had been an XO for a year or so just to have a better understanding of what really is probably the busiest job in the ship, which is the executive officer's job. You know, a good executive officer makes the captain's life just a joy, because he really lifts so much of the weight from his shoulders and looks after all the nitty-gritty. And it lets the captain get on with the sort of the policy side, which isn't all that tremendous in many ways. But I guess above all, having a chance to think about the operation of the ship. You know, when you went out on an exercise, you'd had time to read up the op order and know what you were going to do and talk to the captains of the other ships that you're going to be working with and so on. Whereas if you were worried about the housekeeping and the, you know, whether you're going to have defaulters tomorrow in the morning and the leave and all those sort of things that XOs worry about. Whether the ship side should be painted today, or maybe we should paint the ship side tomorrow and we shall paint the funnel today instead. You know, all that sort of stuff, which is time consuming. A good XO does it all and leaves his captain in peace and quiet to do his thing. And I was blessed with a good XO. And I had we ran about 135, 140 bodies. And they were a good bunch of guys. There were some real skates amongst them, you know, real characters. And, you know, we just had a, you know, it was a very super time in my life. And of course, one never forgets the first, even though I was lucky enough to get others after it. I guess the first ship you get is always that special, special case. And,
you ended up on Provider, I know. And,
No, I had Yukon in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So
the first one,
that was a good one.
Right?
First one really counts, yeah. And we did a lot of steaming. We steamed from Halifax down to the West Indies and around and about. We went up to St. Lawrence and did a Sea Canada first tour for the UNGDs. We did a Iceland trip and And of course, a lot of
you
Bermuda
were
time and what have
you. Like today.
Yeah, we were traveling. And she was in the 7th Squadron, and I had a good bunch of other captains in the squadron. Don't think I really ever got on super well with my squadron commander. He and I were different characters altogether, and however, that in those days he didn't ride the ship, he drove his own ship. And,
which was good.
That was fine. And they tell me that we did seem to do all right. And as I said, I guess our best trip was we did a deployment south with the fleet. And we left the boss behind. He was refitting. And so we sallied forth with a naval aviator, in fact, driving the Victoriaville, was the senior of the three of us. And he was a good scout. And then the other guy was now Vice Admiral Fulton, who's just going off to Brussels as the Canadian military representative in Brussels. And so Andy Fulton and myself and Bill, we went down and we did our thing in the West Indies for 2.5 months, and it's good time, good time.
Nothing like having a ship, though.
No. And, you know, it's interesting because remember we were talking one day and we were coming back and we figured out that in all the sort of general drills, like officer watch maneuvers and boat work and what have you, the three little frigates invariably, and I'm not saying it because I had the frigate, I mean it was the frigates in general in Halifax, we invariably ran rings around the destroyers. And I think it was, we were all 2.5, old ships, you know, much older than the destroyers. These are some of the new Anarons as well as the Tribals.
Trying harder?
We were just trying hard, right. And we were, the only thing we knew we couldn't beat them at was speed, because we could only do 15.5 knots flat out downhill. But in every other respect, we invariably beat them handstand, which was, you know, satisfying to look back on.
Well, how does it feel now being base commander? Being a colonel, you know, I hate throwing that much. Yeah. I know it's a little low, but you're on ground and you're a colonel.
Yeah.
Does that bug you?
No, because although I'm on the beach, because it's this particular base, you know, I'm still a captain in my own service in a sense. Although
yeah.
I have a hell of a lot of soldiers and airmen and super guys too. They are working for me. But I'm surrounded with ships and the naval atmosphere. To me, I consider that it's yet just another case of being terribly lucky to get the job, because in fact it's another command job. And in fact, my wife and I were talking one day about sort of the things we've done over the years, and in fact, if you add up my sort of 30 whatever number of years it is now, I had my sort of initial 2 years in England. Then I had my year in England on my long course. And then I had command of Lanark for 2 years. And then I had command of Yukon for 2 years. And then I had command of Provider for 2 years. And then I had 2 years on the directing staff at Greenwich. And now I've got the base. So that's 2 years. So we're now talking something like 14 or more years of my life have been in rather super jobs, you know, command or sort of out of country doing some job which is very fascinating. So I ain't got no complaints, you know, really. and RMC, you see, was different.
Yeah.
A year at Toronto Staff College.
Was the Air Force College.
Air Force Staff College. So, you know, I've certainly not had the conventional naval career of Halifax, Ottawa, maybe West Coast in between, then back to the Ottawa, Halifax run.
Yeah.
I mean, some very good friends of mine, you know, one particular I'm thinking of who's a Commodore, has never steamed the ship out here. I think he was out here once for about 6 months. He's never served out of country, and he's literally gone Halifax, Ottawa, with a side diversion to Toronto RCF Staff College and a side diversion to NDC.
Is that why he's a Commodore?
Maybe it is, I don't know. That's a good point. But
no,
I wouldn't swap mine.
No, I wouldn't swap mine. But is it because he's in the Ottawa circuit? Is it part of promotion too?
No. No, I have implicit faith in the promotion system. And I don't think it matters who in the hell where you are. If you do a good job, it's recognized, you get promoted. If you screw up, you don't get promoted, you know. As simple as that.
How did you feel about integration? We don't have very much tape left.
Traumatic. On the other hand, I felt that it was easier to take because RMC was all Army. The administration, all the people I worked with other than one naval officer were all Army. So I sort of knew something about soldiers. I'd had my year at Toronto at the Air Force at the Staff College, so I knew the airman side of the house. I guess the initial word, which was integration, sat better than unification. I certainly didn't like taking off my suit and putting on another one. On the other hand, I was again lucky, I guess, in that this was what, 1967, right? We sort of had it. And I fled the country and I went to UK on the directing staff at Greenwich for 2 years. By the time I got back from there, I went straight to sea in Yukon, and nothing had changed in the ships other than we wore a different uniform. By the time I got out of Yukon, we were 4 years into it, and a lot of the dust had settled, and you could see that in fact things were going to settle down and sort themselves out. It was going to take time, it was going to take a lot of work, but it was going to be all right. You know, we still haven't finished the job yet. I don't suppose we ever will, but you know, we're a lot better off now than we were, say, in 1969, 1970. But I guess I was a coward. I managed to avoid it, you see, by being 2 years in England and then hiding away at sea, which, as I say,
I know
in the
I was very disappointed.
You know,
there was
a lot of emotion crept in, tremendous amount of emotion. I deliberately, I deliberately tried to not get wrapped up emotionally. I tried to see the good things out of it, and there were some. There were a lot of good things that came out of it. I felt that there was no sense making a mountain out of things that were not absolutely vital. It hurt to take off a uniform and put on a strange new uniform, but on the other hand, it wasn't worth destructing the service over the color of the cloth or the shape of the gold braid. There were far more important things to worry about than that. When I got really involved with it, I was back into personnel work. The more I dealt with, and this time, of course, I was dealing with right across the spectrum of all classifications of officers. The more I worked with these guys, the more I realized that we had a tremendous amount we could learn from them, and I'm sure that they learned a hell of a lot from us. When I say us, the Navy, and I was learning from
different
them.
There was
a lot of parochial feeling creeping in. People with access to grind, people who were trying to make a name for themselves, perhaps.
Well, the old regiments and the different uniforms,
well,
and all this type of thing.
The traditional stuff is... it's terribly bad, terribly vital, and it did go down. But as I say, you know, we haven't finished yet. It's coming back. Go down the road and visit the Princess Patricia's, you know, and the regimental.
They're hanging on.
That's right. The regimental system is alive and well. Go down to any ship, and the ship spirit is alive and well, and still doing its thing. The naval spirit is alive and well in the land, amongst the naval community. The guys who have the most difficult row to hoe are the support trades, the administrative clerks and the supply technicians,